Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for dropping along tonight, where Martin O'Shaughnessy makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce him briefly. He's well known to many of you through his work capacity, but educated at the University of Wollongong, studied in economics and industrial relations, worked briefly for BHP, became Chief of Staff to an independent member in the New South Wales Parliament, where the independents played a very important role in that period of time. Became Director of Research and Government Affairs for the Australian Association of National Advertisers, and between 2005 and the end of 2014, he ran NewsPoll, which, as you all know, is published in the was then and still is published in the Australian. And in more recent times, Martin O'Shaughnessy has been a partner at Omnipoll. And the topic for tonight is, can we trust opinion polls? The United States in 2016, Australia in 2018. Martin O'Shaughnessy, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. And it's very nice to be here for my first time. I'm going to work between a written presentation and a PowerPoint, and my voice is going to be captured by a lapel mic, so I'll try to make it as seamless as possible. I'm accustomed to standing under the PowerPoint and pointing at slides, so please put up with me if I move around a bit. I've entitled my talk, Rotten Luck and Self-Inflicted Wounds, How the US Pollsters Failed in 2016 and Why a Similar Result is Unlikely in Australia. So let's take a little walk down memory lane, and we remember that not so long ago in America, we saw this happen. And everybody told us to expect this, a Clinton win. But what we got was this. That was his smuggest face in the campaign, I think. And that was confusing because Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. 48% of the popular national vote went to Clinton, 47% went to Trump, but Trump got 57%. Of the Electoral College votes available, and we all know the rest is history. So how did that happen? And why wouldn't it happen here? And really, can we trust this guy next time he phones us up? And I say yes, emphatically, mostly. So, to get through this talk, we're going to look at how polling is done right, why it's actually harder to do that in the United States, and why and how they got it so wrong in 2015, and why Australia is different. So, how is it done right? Rather than give you a lecture, I'll tell you a story. The person in this photo is George Gallup, the father of modern polling. And his story, a very interesting one for us pollsters, takes place in 1936. In 1936, there was a presidential election on, and I'm sorry if that's too small for you to read, but there were two polls going on before the 1936 presidential election. In the run-up to that particular election, a prominent magazine, the Literary Digest, which, yes, was the progenitor of the Reader's Digest, conducted a poll with 2.3 million responses. And they predicted a run-out victory for a fellow by the name of Alf Landon. Has anybody previously heard of Alf Landon? No, indeed not. The Roosevelt win is now history, of course, but how indeed did George Gallup, who only had 1,500 people in his poll, actually do so well and get it so right? Well, the Gallup poll was conducted among people eligible to vote. And in fact, the Literary Digest poll was conducted among the wrong people, only people who had registered cars and telephones, which at the time, of course, was the well-heeled American and not the everybody who was entitled to vote at the time. Gallup polled women, which was virtually unheard of, and African-Americans, and poor people. And he did it in lots of different places, and he used a random method of approaching people in the street, and effectively he founded and started, if you like, the modern method of doing polling well. And in fact, polling was brought here by Roy Morgan, who went to America to study under Gallup and learned his methods, and he brought those methods here to Australia. The important thing that this poll and this approach that Gallup developed tells us is the two key things that every poll has to do very, very well. And that is, every poll must reflect the sample that you're taking it there. Sorry, must give every potential respondent a chance to participate. You cannot make a poll which just allows people who subscribe to your website or to your magazine. And the next thing is that the sample has to reflect the structure of the population. So if there are women voting, you've got to ask a few women. If there are African Americans voting, you have to ask them. As a result, these basic rules have been applied through everything that I've ever done at News Poll and in every successful poll we've seen. And so it sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? Just make sure you give everybody a chance to participate and then make sure that you ask enough people of each type who will be voting. So why is it so hard? The US is a very fiendishly difficult system to predict. Structurally difficult, and it has an optional voting system that is exceptionally hard to predict, especially when new things happen. So let's look first at the simple Australian system. Here is a picture of Australia, and as you can see, there are 150 electorates, and each of those electorates is roughly the same population. Each returns the same number of representatives, one, and in each, turnout is compulsory and very predictable. So nationally, sample polls, like the News Poll we see every second Tuesday or Monday, gets a two-party vote, which is pretty close to the right answer. And that two-party vote is usually a very good guide to the number of seats that will go to each party. This differs from the US system in every important respect. Here is a picture of the US system, and you can see there are 50 states, but all of them have different populations. Each returns a different number of electoral college votes. A vote for an individual presidential candidate is actually a vote for his or her slate of electors, which means effectively that each state is electing both houses with one vote. They have a winner-takes-all approach, which means you may win by 50% plus one vote, but all of the electoral college votes in a given state generally go to the winner, except for Nebraska and Maine, who allocate electors proportionally, and there is no constitutional compulsion on electoral colleges to vote in either direction or with either proportionality. So, very different. For individuals, voting, even registration, is not compulsory as it is here, so turnout is unpredictable and fluctuates a lot depending on the electoral circumstances. So, in the US system, the national two-party vote has proven to be a very poor indicator of the number of electoral college votes to be won by each party. Now, I make no comment on whether either system serves democracy well, but I will say that our system greatly simplifies the role of pollsters to get it right, and to do so at reasonable cost. The US system is really so much more complicated that it requires many more educated guesses and many more dollars to poll well. Okay, to illustrate this, I'm going to leave the podium and point to some numbers, if that's okay with you. And I will try to keep my voice up so you can all hear. This little complicated thing shows the polls and the actual result in Australia in 2013 and in the US in 2016. And what it shows is, this was the News Poll taken the week before the election, and it said that there would be a swing against the government of 4.1%, and if we just read the electoral pendulum, that there would be a change of seats of 14. What actually happened was a 3.6% swing, which, pretty good poll result. Reading the electoral pendulum, that should have given a change of seats to change hands of 13, and what actually happened, because of the vagaries of the electorate level stuff down at the marginal electorates, we had 17 seats actually change hands at the election. Now, 14, 13 and 17, all close numbers. And if you came up with 14 or 17,
you'd have been still on the money for, you know, what was going to happen, which was an increasing marginalisation of the government. What happened in the US in 2016? The national poll showed swings of minus 2.5% against Clinton, or against the Democrats. And that should have led to a movement of 30 electoral college votes. What actually happened was 2.9%, so the poll was quite, one of the best polls was quite close. It should have led to a 16-seat change, but in fact, 105 electoral college votes changed hands. Now, the difference, this is a very accurate poll at a national level, and yet it utterly failed to predict the outcome. Whereas in Australia, a slightly less accurate poll did a great job of predicting the outcome, and so our system is inherently easier to predict, and the US system is prey to variation that's very hard to factor in, even if you get the poll right, which of course is a big assumption. Okay, so what were those one-off features? As I said earlier, there were things that just made it harder in 2016, even though they have a hard system to measure already. And those things were Trump supporters were under-polled but turned out. If you listened carefully to the campaign, Trump actually said, polls, they're all fake, don't pick up the phone, don't answer them. If you support me, just come out and vote. And actually, that happened. There was a strong voting divide on education in 2016, and it was completely unlike 2012. Now, why is that an issue? Because the way you are educated affects the way you turn out and the way you vote. There was also a higher turnout of disaffected voters who'd been previously unpollable. So we saw a rather well-heeled journalist talking about the sharecroppers who had never voted before turning out for the first time. It's generally believed that that actually happened. And of course, as they are unpollable in the first place, it's impossible to take their views into account. So, again, that made it harder for the pollsters to get it right. But they could have allowed for these things, and those things could have been white noise if they had not done some other fairly stupid things. Okay, so what were those stupid things? How did they get things so wrong in 2016? Remember what we're trying to measure. We've got 50 states. They're all different, but if you measure each state accurately, then you should be able to say what the result will be in each state within a margin of error, and then get the big picture right. So, what should happen when you do this sort of thing is do 50 separate state polls, worst case, to know what's happening in every state, to do them at a state level, make them high quality, ignore the national numbers because I've just shown you they don't contribute to the electoral college numbers to be decided, and get the state polls right. So, what did actually happen? Well, there were 39 at least state polls, federal polls, which were generally irrelevant to the outcome. They were well-managed, well-conducted, high-quality polls. Their average was accurate to within 2% of the real outcome, and they were completely irrelevant. There were at least 208 state-level polls. Now, these should have predicted the outcome. There were so many of them. There was more than four per state. But they were, on the whole, done cheaply online, using online panels. Only 12% of the state-level polls were conducted using high-quality methods like operator telephone, that is a real person, not a machine. And the majority were just, you know, low-cost, high-error polling systems. So the critical, necessary, important state polls were mostly wrong, with errors averaging 5%, but a spread of 10% across the most estimates at a state level, which led to another problem later. It made them lack credibility because people couldn't interpret what these widespreads would mean. While the irrelevant national polls were mostly right, with errors only at 2%. So, all right, why? I've already given you a hint talking about the low-quality online polling that was used. The polling industry and their main customers, the media, can be excused for some rotten luck, because they did get some rotten luck, but mainly, their errors were self-inflicted wounds. Let's talk about the bad luck, because, you know, that's the nice thing to do. First, it wasn't really their fault. Pollsters in the States are forced to weight their results by expected outcome. This is because a person may say they favour a given party one way or the other, but the way they vote doesn't count until they actually turn out and vote. So the poll can say one thing, person doesn't turn up, result is different. This is one of the issues with non-compulsory turnout. As I said earlier, in 2016, the turnout nationwide grew more in Republican counties than in Democrat counties compared to 2012. So in 2016, many pollsters assumed the turnout rates we found in 2012, which is a good thing to do. Let's take recent past experience and we'll use that as our model. Unfortunately, that led to an overestimation of the Democrat vote and an underestimation of the Republican vote. So on turnout, pollsters basically zigged when they should have zagged. Just that simple. Just a, you know, an error that anyone could make. We certainly used at News Poll things that happened last year, such as preference allocation or at the last election, with regularity, and it was a good way of doing it. It's just very unfortunate that this time around it compounded the error rather than reduced it. The second issue, very poor survey technique. It seems amazing to me to say, but many state polls did not wait for education. This was a serious, avoidable error. At News Poll and now OmniPoll, part of our secret sauce is to weight by education, because they're intimately tied to voter perceptions, to how they'll turn out and how they'll vote. And these numbers are from the Pew Institute American Voter Survey. I'm going to return to the screen to point them out to you. These numbers here represent the turnout rates by education level. The purple turnout rate is the highest education level, and the blue turnout rate is the lowest education level. And it's very clear that you are more likely to answer a poll and more likely to turn out if you are more educated. So you need to know, if you're a pollster, the education level and wait for it. And in the US in 2012, it wasn't really a great difference in voting intention. This is the 2012 result, Democrat or Republican. But in 2016, there was a huge 8-point gap, Democrat to Republican, based on education level. Again, if they'd weighted by education, they wouldn't have had a problem with that. They'd have known that was coming. But because they didn't, it threw their numbers out a long way. There was a large number, I mentioned all earlier, of cheap polls. So on the, I'm sorry about the quality of the projection, but on the right here is the national polls. The purple bit at the top is the number that were done by human-operated telephone, about a third, and another bunch here were the next level down, which is machine-operated telephone. But generally speaking, these guys got it right. There weren't that many of them. They were well-funded and they were of a good size. This is the state-level polls, the ones that should have been right. Okay, this is the number, 12%, that was done the right way. 88% were done in cheaper other ways. And they have proven to be wrong. And the huge spread on the results that they generated was also a major problem for the next thing that happened, or this one after the one, which is that these misleading poll results were amplified by poll aggregators. Who's heard of Nate Silver? Okay, Nate Silver's a pollster, right? No, he's not. Nate Silver is a mathematician who used to run a way of predicting baseball team outcomes. And he's got some very good mathematics. Monte Carlo simulation, which is the main tool under the hood for these guys, is what they use to predict the outcomes of nuclear explosions in the Manhattan Project. It's good stuff. And they've got their own really good weighting systems. They are their own systems, and they are, if you like, self-devised, and therefore also exposed to confirmation bias, which was a big issue for pollsters and media in the 2016 election. The issue for these guys was that they, using the published work of the poor quality pollsters, of course simply reinforced poor quality numbers. If you have 88% of polls done the wrong way and you feed them into a mathematical system, the old adage of garbage in, garbage out applies. And in 2016, it did so in spades. 538's prediction of a 70 to 90% chance of a Clinton victory was considered by some observers, such as Frank Luntz, to be a bit light on, a bit gutless. He said 99% chance. So we can see what that actually led to. There was also a vicious cycle of self-confirming inaccuracy. And you watch it happening. We've heard the expression, never Trump. Journalists would pass the flyover states to attend their conferences on either major coastline. And of course, here we have this wonderful situation there, Phil, where lots of cheap polls were fed into the systems that came out and said, well, you know, the model says this is what's going to happen. These were confirmed by the irrelevant national polls, which led to people publishing more poor quality polls and believing them. It was very simple. And, the system having the aggregators in there, because they had done so much better than some of the pollsters in previous elections, made them believable. But, as I say, garbage in, garbage out. In the glow of 2020 hindsight, we also now see that many media outlets were focusing on the polls that confirmed their preformed view of what should happen, not what was going to happen. Okay, so far, so bad. So why wouldn't this happen in Australia? Remember, it starts with this simple system that we have here where everything is pretty uniform. And frankly, our system is simpler and therefore more easily and cheaply measured well. The effect of our compulsory enrolment and turnout is to create what is essentially a homogenous system, an homogenous system. Every citizen, virtually everybody we reach on our phone surveys, is a voter and is likely, or rather compelled, to at least turn up at the ballot box on election day. The result is that national polls most often reflect voter behaviour very well. And we've all heard of the electoral pendulum. Generally speaking, that gets the answer pretty close to right. And, has proved to be a great indicator along the way. And because of these factors, a good indicator of all state and federal polls really can come with simply two things. We do a 1,500 sample poll nationally to get the pendulum in the right place, and maybe another 1,500 sample poll in the marginal seats, just to make sure that down at the end where things turn, we're not making any big mistakes. And generally speaking, that's led to a very good outcome for pollsters. I would take my hat off to David Briggs, who is now doing News Poll. He got it within 0.5% and got the number of seats to change hands pretty well spot on in the last election, and so did we. Okay. So the result of all of this is that our polling landscape, A, is easier to measure and therefore favours quality. Okay. This leads to fewer high-quality polls. So in Australia, in the run-up to an election, there'll be a couple of dozen really good polls, done by well-established agencies, published in major national newspapers. The vast majority of them will be done by human-operated telephone, using random digit dialing and all of the mod cons that we can bring to bear to make sure we get a sample of everybody, so we don't exclude anybody. And, of course, the wonderful quality data we get from the Australian Electoral Commission and the census, thank you, ABS, allow us to really know what we're sampling and to design A, the sample, and B, our weighting schemes to actually reflect what we're trying to measure. And so we have very good systems. We don't have them because we're geniuses, well, we are. We have them because they're easier to do here and we have the data to feed them, and anyone with a bit of common sense and a bit of an understanding of what they're doing can actually produce a poll, provided they have the right approach, that will predict the outcome quite closely. So, how have the polls performed? Okay, I'm going to return and point now because this is my favourite part of the presentation. These red ones are the difference between the actual national poll result and the news poll published on the Friday before the election. And as you'll see, they've stayed under 2% except for 2004. I joined the firm in 2005 and took over the polling. Compare this to the US national polls, which were the most accurate that they had, and of course the US state polls average error difference from the actual result. And you'll see, generally speaking, polling in Australia has actually lived up to the expectation I'm setting up for it, which is that it's better than what's going on, certainly in 2016, in the US context. So, there endeth my little bit of self-indulgence. However, surprises can happen. Who recognises all of these faces? Hawke, Howard and Mike Rand. all of whom won with less than 50% of the actual, on the day, national vote. Fortunately, the polls picked this up too. But, you know, you can get a surprise where you get the poll right, and you still don't pick the Prime Minister right because the vagaries of marginal seats changing hands in, you know, at a very marginal level by a few votes either way can mean, as for Mike Rann, that you can get 48% of the national vote, of the state vote, and still win government by a seat or two. So that's just to keep things interesting. What are the prospects for polling in 2018 and as we go into the next election? Pollsters on the whole do their best to accurately reflect current opinion. And the reality is we don't predict the future. We'd like to think so, but that's not true. While some bad luck and significant poor practice have been found in the US polls in 2016, two major issues for US pollsters are really hurting them, and they are cost pressure and the complex environment that is expensive to measure well. You put those together, you're going to get problems. I also advance the proposition that the tendency for media to view polls as content is contributing to an interest in a volume of polls rather than a quality of polls. Media proprietors want a lot of polls to do a lot of circulation boosts rather than to really know the answer. And, you know, we've never found that. I have to say that the Australian has always prized quality and allowed us to do a great job and, you know, paid the cost. As a result, you've seen, you know, our results over time. In fact, we have a 100% record in predicting state and federal elections since the founding of the firm in 1985. It's not bad. Not one have we ever got wrong. So, while the Australian pollster faces some of the cost pressures that US pollsters now face, our system remains inherently easier to measure and easier to measure at a reasonable cost. So, assuming there's no dramatic decline in the budgets provided by the media proprietor, I believe there's every reason to expect that polls we see in the coming year will be a very good indicator of the outcome at the next election. However, I want to point out one thing, and this is where I'm going to do a little bit of ad as the former chairman of our industry body, AMSRO. One of the key problems that the APOR study found in the American polls was that so many people are not landline holders anymore, and because of their system, it's very hard to get hold of good lists of phone numbers. Now, we're facing a similar problem in Australia at the moment. Remember the basics, which is every voter needs a chance to participate, so you've got to have a way to get to everybody, and that the sample needs to reflect the population. Well, we can do that by quotering, but how do we get to everybody? We have a bit of a problem. I'm going to go back to the pointing at the slide thing again for a minute to show you something. The red bit is the number of people, or the proportion of people, now excluded by the method that I'm pointing to. So this is landline telephone, 30% are excluded. This is online panel, 97 to 98% of people are excluded. Mobile phone, 93% are included, only 7% excluded, and that's falling. Because there's more mobile phones than there are people in Australia, and now mobile is the way to go. But we have a bit of a problem. In the recent past, pollsters like me could get the white pages. We would literally tear a page out of the book or get an electronic copy and use those numbers to phone people randomly. Because we need to move to mobile phones, it becomes a problem that there is no published phone book with mobile phones in it. There is a phone book. It's called the IPND. It's owned by government, managed by Telstra on behalf of ACMA. And our industry has been trying for many years to get hold of that list because we've been seeing this looming problem that people are no longer using landlines. So, if you ever get a chance to talk about that or someone mentions it to you, that industry's trying to get hold of mobile phones, it's true. And the Communications Department has actually recommended it to the minister who lately became our Prime Minister. So it happened, hit his desk far too late for him to take an interest. But our industry has been crying out for this for a long time, and I've personally been working on it for about 8 years. Okay, moving right along. I'm going to hand over to you. Are there any questions?
I think I'll take over.
Really?
I'm trying to preserve my position. So many thanks to Martin O'Shaughnessy, who thinks he can give the talk and run the Q&A, but he can't. So we'll go to Q&A. So you come back here, and let's start off. We've got plenty of time. Thanks for an engaging and very well explained presentation. Now, as you know, we're in the time of by-elections, and it seems that there is arguments about how you poll a particular seat. Now, I'm not an expert, but it appears that the polls that were done in relation to the Longman by-election in Queensland, the federal sphere, seem to have been not very accurate. However, the polls that seem to have been done in Wagga in the New South Wales seat last weekend appear to have been accurate. So why is it said to be more difficult to poll a single seat? Is that correct? And if it is correct, why does someone get it right and someone not get it right?
Okay, so there's two questions there. The first question is, why is it harder to poll a single seat? And the answer is, let's take a typical federal seat, which will have 100,000 electors, 50,000 households. It doesn't matter how many electors there are, you still need 500 or 1,000 interviews, because that's how it works. You know, once you get to that kind of a number, you're going to get a good result, no matter how large the population is. So it works on the downside, which is just getting enough people to come to the phone and answer when you're doing a single electorate is hard. That's why you need to have real people chasing down people and getting appointments and making sure that the people of the different age groups are answering, in particular young males, very hard to get. Because it's cheap, lots of people use IVR. You know, you pick it up and you get this machine voice saying, hello, we're calling from ReachTel. I don't mean to mention brands. And then you get the poll. The hang-up rate on a IVR poll is between 97 and 99%. That is 1% of people bother to finish the poll, or maybe 3. So in an electorate with 100,000 voters, you have to have phoned every single household up to twice to get the poll result. So what's happening there is, because you need to get that 1,000, if you choose that other cheaper method, and it is a lot cheaper, it's cents per call, not dollars, you're going to get an unrepresentative sample and it's going to be inaccurate. So I've answered both questions there. If you use a cheap method, you're going to get an inaccurate result. It's not possible to use online panel in an individual electorate, because the largest panel in Australia has 200,000 people on it. You divide that by 150 and you get a number just over 1,000. Even if they all answered in a given electorate, you couldn't get a good result either. So it's about phone and it's about poor quality phone. It's just that simple. There's nothing complicated about the way people behaved in either of those by-elections. They are entirely predictable outcomes.
Stay here. Oh. Susan.
Martin, you said that the work is focused on current opinion. I'm wondering if you can give us insights into a pollster's mind on what constitutes a material change to trigger a new current situation. What are the sorts of factors that...
Are you after a political opinion, or are you after a technical response? So you're talking about the change in the polls that's followed the change in Prime Minister.
Well, I guess if you're looking at current opinion, what are the material factors that change currency?
Well, we've had a bit of a break there. Could you just explain, just summarise the question before you answer?
Yes, indeed. So I'm being asked, we only report current opinion. So what changes current opinion? Why do people change their minds? And there are some long answers and some short answers in that, but I think the two, you know, observing this over time, disappointment is poison. Right? Disconfirmation of positive expectations is worse than just hating your enemy. It causes more disaffection. So, you know, Kevin Rudd had a 63% two-party vote the day before he went to Copenhagen. And when he came back and said, oh, I'm really sorry, I tried hard, but I couldn't do it, it dropped to 52% in 2 weeks because he disappointed people. So that's one of the major changes. The slow burn type issues are health, education, economy. They are always the most important because they have the most direct effect on the welfare of the individual voter. And they always juggle for position. When interest rates are up, the economy is more important. When things are good, health and education are more important for the average voter. And so those three things tend to bubble along together as issues. There was an interesting dynamic when both major parties sort of said, OK, the environment's now important, and it started to come up. But as soon as they both stopped talking about it, it started to drop down again. So the things that seem to be heterogeneously important, health, education, economy, because it hits my back pocket. And as they move, people's voting intentions move. Here's an interesting thing. I did a little study of the re-election of incumbent governments between 1961, the year of my birth, and 2013, the last time I did the federal election in Australia. And over 90% of re-elected incumbent governments were re-elected on a rising economy. And the majority of kick-outs happened on a falling economy. Are we surprised? So the economy is really important.
Question up there? I thought you were. Okay. Here.
Thank you, Martin, for a great talk. Given the great quality of Australian polls, who are the best payers?
The best payers? Well, if you're a pollster, you want News Limited as your customer, because they're there every fortnight. If you have Fairfax as your customer, you might be lucky to get four a year. So, News Limited. I've signed my non-disclosure agreement.
There's a question there. Speak into the microphone.
If you look at Britain, how good are the polls there? Because there you have non-compulsory voting and first past the post.
They're about the same as we found in the States in the last few years. Evidence the failure of the polls to predict Brexit and the utter stupidity of Theresa May to go back to the electorate on the strength of a honeymoon poll, which of course is completely wrong. The Australian Elector Survey, which occurs after each federal election, Ian McAllister runs that at ANU, shows us that more people claim to have voted for the winner than actually did on election day. So there is a bandwagon effect, but it follows after the election, not before. And Theresa May was in the warm glow of that particular event when she called another snap election, failing to realise that her vote wouldn't change much. It didn't. But all of the minor parties who didn't have the budget to compete again were soaked up by the Labor Party, hence the result.
Right, there's a question down the front here.
In your experience, is there a behavioural effect of polls that, predict a particular outcome that, electors may not like, and then they change their voting behaviour as a consequence?
I don't think so, but both major parties appear to. Here's an interesting story. During 2007, my first federal election for News Poll, I was predicting a strong Rudd outcome 6 months out. And I used to get this hot phone call from Chris Mitchell. I'd be, "This can't be right. Labor can't win. What are you talking about?" I've just had both parties in here telling me that we've got Labor too high and the Coalition too low. This stems from the Labor Party's view that the big polls that in 1983 that showed a landslide for Bob Hawke actually led to people not voting for them, which I disagree with. And of course, a former Prime Ministerial Chief of Staff, not the one in this room, has told me that the Liberal Party raises all of its funds shortly after the election mostly, and they've got to look like winners, otherwise people aren't prepared to bet on them. And so both parties have their own reasons for telling the same lie to the same newspaper editor on the same day, which gave me some serious headaches. But no, I don't agree. I think that's a furphy. I think that's a thing that the parties want us to believe so they can game the current state of play during the election process and the publishing of the polls.
You haven't mentioned it, but to what extent is it necessary for the answers that you receive in a survey to be truthful?
It's not. it's not. We weed out people we think are giving us nonsensical answers. But here's the interesting thing. The shy voter, who might tell you one thing and mean another. You know, for example, people saying, oh, shy voters didn't say they would vote for Trump. I don't really think that's right. I've listened in on the polls, and the simple fact of the matter is we get the results so close to the actual outcome, it couldn't be largely affected by lying. The academic papers I've read say, well, Liberal voters are just as likely to lie as Labor voters, and it becomes white noise that cancels each other out. It creates some noise because you don't get the truth, but they do tend to cancel one another out. And I've got plenty of answers.
That's why I'm going to ask the question, Martin. I'm wondering if we could, for a moment, consider retail of your data as distinct from wholesale. So let's stand back a little. So the retail is going into the paper, it's going to the mass media, and it's going to be a discussion point. Now, as we know, our census data is probably, arguably, the best in the world.
Not arguably, definitely.
Okay, and there are many statistical techniques that can be used, and you'd know more about that than I do, a correlation and regression analysis. We also know from the news where the votes were cast. So I'm wondering if you could share with us some more intimate insights into how you provide consulting information to the major parties and the small parties, which would be terribly valuable.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the honourable member for Warringah. I don't provide any data to any political parties, never have. However, we involve ourselves on a commercial basis in a number of things. A small coal miner in Queensland who is going to be steamrolled along with the Darney, even though they provide local jobs, look after the land, buy their wastewater from the Toowoomba sewage plant, and do everything right, we're still going to get killed off. So, we did a bit of polling that helped the owners of that mine to understand that locals really wanted their mine to go ahead, and the people of Queensland supported them if they really wanted it to go ahead. So we then did a campaign that allowed people to see that to happen. It's now public knowledge that in about 2011, 12, 13, the automakers, the big one Toyota, pulled out early, and so the government shut down the automotive adjustment scheme. You know, precipitously, of course, harming small manufacturers. We did a poll which looked at the six Sandbelt electorates that particular measure was going to harm, and we didn't do any campaign. We just showed the government of the day that if they continued to do this, the 12% of people who felt they owed their job to the automotive industry would vote against them. And in fact, only half of the people who were affected by the measure were aware of it at that point. So we said to government, on behalf of the automakers, if this is campaigned, it'll get bigger. So rather than campaigning or making a problem for the government, we just gave them the good oil and they changed the plan. And November that year, it was put back on. So these are two examples of how it's done down at a very micro level. Only six electorates.
Martin, thank you. You talked a lot about the methodology of the pollster. I was wondering, politics seems to go in cycles, and we're now in a cycle where we're certainly seeing in regional areas more interest in independence. We're also seeing various minor parties over the last few elections. And reasonably oddly for Australia, we sort of now talk about potential for hung parliaments. And sitting in all of that, of course, is the whole area of preferences, particularly when you've got more smaller parties and independents around. What effect is that going to have on the accuracy of the Australian pollsters going forward, this sort of instability and more choice of parties?
On the whole, not much. Because because of our system, we already know who is going to run in every electorate by the time the poll is declared or the order of the ballot is drawn a few weeks out from the election. So when we go into that last phase, knowing who is there. We actually divide it up in a way, so if I am in, if I'm in any given seat, I can name all of the actual candidates, and our computer systems do that. So the technical issue of dealing with the variety of candidates that is now popping up has been fixed up by the ability for the computer to say, we're in Warringah, you know, the incumbent is Abbott, you know, the other guy is whoever, and away we go. The bigger picture story, though, is how long is that cycle? And we're going through a period where today people my age, just short of 60, have three times the assets of any of their children. Baby boomers, you know, 25% of the population, 55% of the assets. Those people coming through are the people who are doing it tough. That's happening worse in regional electorates because of the job drain out of the country areas. So they're feeling, again, economic pressure much more strongly than city areas, but the wave is coming. And if that's the thing that changes people's intention to vote, it creates a lack of optimism and a willingness to adopt minor parties. There is an inherent benefit to minor parties to campaigning for the small bit off the end. I'll give an example under Chatham House rules. Is that okay?
Not really, no. You're on the record.
I'm on the record. So a place that I polled, a minor party, we said this is a very unpopular measure. Only 20% of people want this to go ahead. So they chose that. And they chose that because they knew that they weren't going to get the majority, but 20% was a comfortable space for them to operate because they didn't expect to win. They just wanted to get a few votes and a bit of electoral funding, I posit.
Right, so we're going over here.
Yeah. I religiously looked at 538 ahead of the 2016 election, only to find that it was quite inaccurate. Have they improved their methodology? I haven't looked at it since.
I don't know. And I think, you know, they're pretty... There have been a few mea culpas, and certainly a lot of people are now looking at how the pollsters behaved, because 538 method works fine, provided the inputs are good. The sad thing was that the 538 numbers reflected things that were being found in the more reassuring national polls, because the widespread on the inputs that were going into 538 from the state polls reduced confidence in them to a degree, but because it all added up and pointed in the same way, so people therefore adopted the easier to accept view. So their methods probably don't need to change, although, you know, you'd need to heavily weight down polls that were not done by, you know, voice operated phone, and in fact I would completely discount them. Human-operated phone. I would discount all other polling methods.
Martin, I'm interested by the fact that you're saying that voice-operated phone is still the most accurate method that you have, and knowing how difficult it is to how many phone calls you have to go through before you get somebody that will actually answer your questions. My question is, do you delve any deeper and beyond the numbers that we see published? That is, to some of the why people are saying what they're doing. And I ask that in this context. If indeed our politics in Australia are becoming more presidential in nature, you tend to vote for this leader over that leader, as opposed to a national candidate versus another national candidate. You, for example, behind the scenes, and perhaps we're unaware of, delve a little deeper into the numbers, having gone to all the trouble of getting that respondent on the phone?
No, we just take whatever they say. Yes. But most importantly, what we want to do is to make sure that once we know the person we're talking to is a certain age and sex and in their given electorate, that we match that up to what's required for the sample and weight them accordingly, and we take their answers at face value. Having said that, I probably conducted over 20,000 interviews online parallel to our telephone polling to just check whether the system was working both ways. And in some cases, we, in fact, for other research companies, in fact, would do surveys on our telephone-based system to create weighting factors that we could add into their online system. So a lot of work behind the scenes to create accuracy, or to what we used to call the war on error. And we had five principal sources of survey error. I'm not going to go into it, but we had systematic ways through every process to look into those, including not accepting the first person to pick up the phone. I want to talk to the person who had the most recent birthday. And it must be a male, aged 24 to 35. And, you know, so the person picking up the phone won't necessarily be in that group, and we randomise it that way. We used to what we call sex phone numbers. So this phone number can only be answered by a male. And we'll just drop that number if we get a female. So that to that level of detail, and we've watched how all of those systems worked over time.
Do you ask additional questions beyond the ones that we know about?
Oh, yes. Yeah. but usually they're for commercial purposes. Yeah. Usually we go, household shopper, what's your education, what's your income, kids in the household, over 18, under 18, all of that stuff, which, of course, would go into our commercial product. It may surprise you, it may not. More than 90% of our total turnover in polling was actually market research, not published polls, at NewsPoll. We were started to do that, but we came up with this idea of doing both together, called an omnibus, and that stuck. And so by the time I finished with NewsPoll, polling was still less than 10% of our total turnover.
Question there.
Polling's obviously learned a lot of lessons over the years, as you demonstrated with Mr. Gallup. And we've sort of got to a point now where polling's almost a daily event. We can't live without knowing what's going to happen with a poll. Can you take us through some of the things that polling has had to learn over the last, say, 30 or 40 years? I mean, there's been the big mistakes on Brexit and the big mistakes on Trump. What has that taught the next lot of polls? So there have been a few missed polls in Australia too. So what are the big lessons that have learned, say, over the last 40 years?
That the main lesson we've learned is that the way you get hold of a respondent is important. That if you don't have everybody able to participate in the survey, then you're not going to get a result. We've known this forever. It's a basic rule of statistics. But, lots of companies, and NewsPoll was there too, tried lots of different methods, mainly because they were cheaper. So our telephone poll was 6 times more expensive than our online poll. It's just the way it is. For $5 or $6, you can produce an outcome online. It cost me $30 to make that response. It cost me $30, and then I had to sell it to make that response with the telephone. So we tried to find ways of making things work. And what we found is you can't wait for people who aren't there. That sounds like a bus going off, but wait as in add weights, as opposed to giving time for them to turn up. If they're not there in the sample, you can't weight them. As a result, you can't make a bad sample a good one. And really, these lessons are very basic, and there's nothing intrinsically smart about technology that's currently being brought to bear. The stuff that uses social media as an approach is fantastic for that proportion of the people who are in social media and active and who participate and who tell the truth and who aren't on multiple panels and. Whereas, convincing someone to pick up the phone, and it's not that hard. For every qualified respondent, for every 7 qualified respondents we reach, we would get 1 interview. So, it used to be 1 every 2nd qualified respondent when I started out 30 years ago. But, it's going down, but it's still doable. So what we're learning most is that the new methodologies can be fine, provided you follow the basic real rules, which are: everybody has to have a chance to be in the survey, and the structure of the sample has to look like the population you're predicting.
You came in, I think you said 1985 is, I think, around the time that the Morgan poll was sort of in decline. Now, I think if you go through into the 60s, probably into the 70s, Morgan essentially knocked on doors and spoke to people. Did things change much when you moved from, when pollsters moved from knocking on doors to phoning?
Yes. They got more accurate, and there's a reason. Technical content. A face-to-face poll is what we call a cluster sample. Now, I had ladies that did this too. They get the brown envelope in the mail, they go out the next day, and they would start at 53 Park Road, Cogra Bay, and they would be required to go to the third house on their left, take the next left corner and go to the third house on their right, then walk to the end of that street and take the next right corner, etc. But if you were to fly up in a helicopter or Google Earth these days and look down, you would see little puddles of sample being taken with big bare patches between. So a cluster sample, that's what this is far less accurate than a completely even, totally random, or in our case, structured sample. And I'll give you another example. The way we did it on the telephone, if I got you to imagine a chessboard up against the wall, when you use the telephone, because you know the geography, you can make sure that you get one interview on every square of the chessboard. When you do cluster sampling, it's like shooting a shotgun at one corner and then a shotgun at another corner and a shot. There's still plenty of checkers that aren't covered. So things changed that way. It became easier to be more reliable.
Sue.
Thanks, Martin. It's often said that betting agencies are as good a predictor of outcomes as pollsters. How's that so?
It isn't. Betting agencies need to get the numbers wrong. Otherwise, people wouldn't bet. Or, if they did, betting agencies wouldn't make money. So betting agencies always have the numbers just wrong enough to encourage the foolhardy to bet on the wrong side. And I've had this argument many times. They, of course, use the polls and their own inputs to understand what's going to happen, and then they set the odds to reflect something different. Otherwise, they wouldn't make money.
This question here.
Simple question. You said,
speaking of the microphone,
you never would do polling for a political organisation, but someone does.
Oh yes.
All these internal polls that we keep hearing about incessantly. Who's doing them, and are they doing them well?
Yes, and they are doing them well. And so, when I last was deeply involved, Crosby Texter did a lot of work for the Liberal Party. I think LNP was with them as possibly. I'm on the record, right? I can't answer that, but I can say that there are well-known Australian companies that are doing a good job, and their numbers are pretty accurate, but they're being used for very strategic and very tactical outcomes, where through an election campaign they'll do lots of polling in very specific areas, you know, overnight, to make sure that what the leader of their party or their candidate says next time around matches what they need to say. And it's very good work. And, you know, they've been successful accordingly, both of the pollsters that have looked after. John Utting was the other from UMR. He looked after the Labor Party in Australia for a very long time. Till he retired, I think his company still has some of the contracts. But you know, that's public knowledge, so I'm happy to say that. But they all do an exceptionally good job, and they spend the money required to do it well.
Just to follow up on that just quickly. So that strategic polling, how you structure the question would influence the outcome?
Yes. The way you structure the question always influences the outcome. This is one of the reasons that the wording of news poll has never changed since 1985. We use exactly the same way of introducing. In fact, I think I can probably recite it. If a federal election were to be held today, which of the following would you give your first preference to? Is it, read out parties in random order, and then if the person says, and I can't say, well, to which of these do you have a leaning, and read them out again, and if it's another party, you say, and which of these, and the list of parties comes out. Those words have been the same since 1985. Very important, because you get a different answer if you ask the question differently.
Yeah.
And very foolish of a pollster to give a, you know, to rely on the results of a biased question or a push poll or anything like that. You know.
Unless you're looking for a specific answer or a specific.
Yes, but that's good enough for the first press release, but it won't stick after that. Because it's just wrong. It's not true.
I mean, I think what you're saying there is you guys, you want to be right.
Absolutely.
Because 95% of the other business depends partly on you being right.
Oh, indeed. Every sales pitch I made said, we have a 100% record of getting it right.
Okay, many thanks.
My joy.
Okay. Well, many thanks to Martin O'Shaughnessy. I'll be very brief. It's an important paper, and we had lots of questions and discussion. I've always thought I knew a reasonable amount about polling, but I learnt a lot tonight. So I'm sure we all learnt a lot tonight. And that's what the Sydney Institute is all about. So as we head off to the next federal election, I think, and even the by-election in Wentworth, I think we have a much clearer understanding of what these polls amount to. So it's great to have Martin here tonight. We'll publish his paper in the Sydney papers online. It'll be on Sky News Extra at the weekend and on our podcast from tomorrow morning. But tonight, Martin, congratulations and see you again sometime in the future.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.